edition of Celayan Filipina's Spark Podcast. It just takes a spark to ignite the world ablaze. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jeannie De Guzman, Director of Marketing for Celayan Filipina, and with me is our co-host, Member at Large, Dr. Beverly Bionis. We are so excited to have with us today the multifaceted, multi-talented woman with such a beautiful voice and a giving heart, Gemma Bulos. Hi, Gemma.
Hi.
Gemma. Welcome. It's so great to have you here. We're so happy to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've taken that leap from what most see as their comfortable security blanket and jumped into a global cause that you're so passionate about. There are a lot of events in your timeline that lead you to where you are today. So let's hear about your story.
I'll try and keep it short because I know this is only a half hour podcast. But so my path actually started out as I was a professional jazz singer and preschool teacher in New York City. Aspiring jazz singer, had all these, you know, almost these wonderful opportunities to get a record deal, to, you know, to work with some of the finest musicians. In fact, I actually ended up being able to work with some of the finest musicians. And then September 11th happened. And on that day, I was supposed to be in the World Trade Center when the planes hit. And instead, I called in sick, which was a totally selfish thing. I didn't want to go to work. I actually wasn't sick. And so, you know, you hear those stories about survival guilt of people who, you know, were like, you know, I was supposed to be there. Why wasn't it me, et cetera? So I started to have a little bit of that. But it was overshadowed by the inspiration that I saw in the people of New York and how they started to come together and just, you know, grieve together, give together, and, you know, and uplift each other together. And I thought it was such an inspiration to see what tragedy inspires. I had this dream, or I was actually in this 10-day silent meditation retreat where I felt like I downloaded this song called We Rise. And it was, I heard the whole thing. I heard the orchestra and I heard the, I heard the backup singers. I heard everything. And for me, writing songs is very painful. It takes me a long time, but this one just felt like it downloaded. And I had this notion that I was supposed to build a million voice choir around the world to sing it. And the song was all about uplifting from tragedy and how people come together and it's their finest, you know, and their, it brings out the finest parts of them. And so I left my life. I gave away all my belongings, took my backpack and my guitar. I had barely $1,000 in my pocket, and I started traveling around the world. And at first it was just going to be for a few months, maybe of a year, but it ended up being like 10 years. And in those travels, I met some of the most extraordinary people, and the people who actually I found my path with, it was totally accidental, because the song, one of the main themes of it is this notion that it takes a single drop of water to start a wave, very similar to your spark and flame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So ours is the ripple, right? And the wave. And because I kept inviting people to see how powerful they are as that drop of water, that their every thought and their word and their action had ever, you know, could ripple out and impact people around them. And so with that, I got invited to the Water for Life conference at the United Nations. And here I am just like using this metaphor of water, but people are starting to recognize me as the water lady. The lady for water. And so, you know, here I am with this hippy-dippy message of like, oh, we're all drops of water and we're all going to be so powerful. And meanwhile, we have all these scientists and researchers saying the next world war is going to be over water. And 3 to 5 million people don't have access. You know, all of these crazy, crazy statistics, and I was boggled.
Right.
But the statistic that was most like that really hit me through the heart was how it affected women and girls, how lack of water and sanitation affected women and girls. Certainly 1.2 billion people not having access to water, certainly 3 to 5 million people dying every year of water-related disease was, you know, was absolutely unfathomable. But when you think about how it affects women and girls, how women are the ones who are the caretakers, they're the ones who are fetching the water, they can spend upwards of 8 to 10 hours just fetching water, so there's no opportunity for them to make any money or earn income. Then you have girls who are following in their mother's footsteps and also, you know, having their monthlies. They can't go to school because there's no water and sanitation facilities. So they drop out. 1 in 10 girls will drop out in the eighth grade because there's no water and sanitation facility.
Wow.
And then when they're, you know, going off and having to relieve themselves openly because there's no toilets or because they're walking far distances to get water, there's actually a ton of violent attacks and even rapes.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you can't imagine that just lack of water and sanitation will cause such major social issues, and especially disproportionately on women and girls. And so that was what turned me. That, you know, my metaphor of water, you know, single enough water turned into my cause. And from that point on, I was like, I needed to learn everything about water and sanitation. I was interviewing people. I was in my travels experiencing it myself because I was in these areas where there were, you know, that were water stressed. And I started to just ask a lot of questions. And I won an award from Queen Latifah and CoverGirl for women changing the world.
Yay!
I know.
She's proud, Gemma.
She still doesn't even know that that was the seed, that single drop that started everything.
Wow.
We would never have been able to start my water projects in the Philippines without that $10,000. And
wow,
she had zero idea that it went from that tiny little seed, you know, that tiny little drop, that $10,000 seed grant, and turned into, you know, years. Yeah, that huge wave of like a million people having access to clean water and sanitation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Gemma,
that's sort of how I got there.
I know, Gemma, your story, when I first heard it, was so inspiring. And I have so many different questions with that because, you know, you talked about that time where you just got up and just sold everything and had this thing in your heart that you wanted to do.
That's incredible.
And you just went on. So tell me, how did you move from that fear and that risk that you were going to take into moving forward with it? Because many of us have that fear and that's what stops us. So tell me that step. How did you get over that?
I love that question. What a fantastic question. I can pinpoint two moments that shifted me, that I was just like one with the universe and just said, you know, whatever you need me to do, I'll do it. You know, whatever the grace of all that is holy, tell me where to go and I will be there, right? And there were two moments. One moment was I had been traveling for a while, probably around 6 to 8 months already, on, you know, with zero money and just sort of meeting the graceful and wonderfully generous people. And I was starting to get really exhausted, and, you know, and the messages from the mom and
you know, what are you doing?
Get a job, you know, go back to school, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, so those voices started getting louder.
Our Filipino culture.
So I am not good. Just go get a job.
I know. Yes. That was perfect, Gemma.
Yeah. And I was about ready to throw in the towel. I was about ready to go home. And I remember getting a voicemail on my phone, and I remember it ringing, and I was driving and I didn't want to pick it up. And I'm really regretting that I didn't, because when I pulled over, I listened to the message, and the message was from my friend. She said, "Gemma, I'm at the United Nations. They just called your song the new human world anthem. Listen."
Whoa.
She put up the phone and you could hear it playing.
Oh my gosh. Did that blow you away?
Totally blew me away.
Oh my gosh.
Well, what made me realize, and I think one of the, the biggest lessons in faith, you know, was I remember there being this moment where I was full of hope, right? And hope, mm-hmm. hope is a beautiful, beautiful, you know, feeling to have, but there is that element of doubt, right? There is that, I hope it happens, but if it doesn't, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. I crossed over from hope into faith. Faith is unwavering. It's mm-hmm. like, you don't even believe it can't happen, right? And from that incident, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, this song is not even mine anymore. This song was never mine. This song belongs, it has a life of its own, and I can decide what I need to be with it. I'm not the owner of this song, but I can be, you know, Frodo, and this song can be the ring, and I can protect it on its way, and I could decide whether I could do it kicking and screaming or in complete and utter service. And that was one of the most powerful moments that I had when I shifted from hope into faith.
Wow.
And then the second moment, in the second moment, I remember a significant, it was another conference I was at. It was another water conference. This gentleman named Satish Kumar, he was a monk in the 1960s who studied with Gandhi. And then he walked around the world in silent and nonviolent violent protest against all the cities that had nuclear arms. And he had invited me to sing at this conference that he was hosting. And he pulled me aside one day and he told me his story. He said, you know, I studied with Gandhi. I had this notion I was going to go around the world to all the cities with nuclear arms, sit down with their leaders and just have tea. And when someone like me in my tradition does this, I have to go to my guru and my teacher to get permission, or at least a blessing, right?
Right.
And so he did, and his guru said, yes, of course, you must do this, but you must do this without any money, because you must believe that everyone you meet is your teacher and your student, and that you will always be taken care of. So wow. Everywhere you go, you will be taken care of. And when he told me that story, he said, Gemma, that's what you're supposed to do. And that's what I did.
Wow.
Wow.
And people took care of you wherever you went.
Totally took care of me. Oh my gosh. There were moments where I met a stranger and she gave me like $2,000. I landed in Korea. I had no idea where I was supposed to go, because I was supposed to go to sing at a women's Buddhist women's conference. I had no idea. I couldn't read any of the signs. I didn't know if there was. I didn't know how to get anywhere. And people completely took care of me. Got me on a bus.
Wow.
I went to Spain. I knew nobody in Spain. I just happened to be waiting. I had gotten. It was a conference on interfaith dialogue, and. I got there. I didn't know where I was going to stay. I put my backpack and my guitar at some random restaurant, and I hid it under a table where nobody was sitting, hoping that, you know, when I went to, cause I couldn't take it to the conference. So I went to the conference and then I was going to go back to get my, you know, my guitar and backpack, hoping they were still there. I don't know what made me think it'd be safe at an open restaurant.
So especially in Spain, right?
I know.
Barcelona. And I didn't speak very good Spanish, so I couldn't even convince anybody, oh, that's mine, right? So, but on my way back, I was at the train station. I wasn't at the restaurant. I wasn't even at the conference. I was at a train station, and a woman, an American woman, just starts talking to me, and we just started having, you know, light conversation. And she stops me and she said, wait a minute, are you Gemma? And I said, are you the Gemma that sings? And I'm like, I'm Gemma and I sing, but there are two of us, right? I think there might be some. And she proceeds to tell me that this friend of hers had told her to find me in Spain. Like, just find me in Spain, right?
Wow.
It turns out her friend was a mutual friend of mine. I was the Gemma she was looking for.
Oh, weird.
She got to talking. She's like, you're going to come stay with me. We got my backpack and my guitar, which was still there. And then I stayed with her for the next 10 days.
Wow.
It was, I mean, people bought me around the world tickets. People let me into
the amazing.
After meeting me like that day in their coffee shop. People were like, I mean, it was extraordinary. Suzuki gave me a car. They gave me a car for a year to drive around and build a choir. It was bananas.
Wow.
Gemma, that's amazing.
Is amazing.
You worked your hope to faith, and those stories you're talking about are definitely faith. And I know you you were used that word accidental. Definitely was not accidental. It was definitely a faith entrepreneur instead of an accidental entrepreneur.
When you started, you said, I was reading in your bio that you, well, not your bio, I was listening to your TED talk, that you almost died a couple times.
Yeah.
And I mean, it led you to doing this. What happened?
Yes. So that one story, it's funny because I've started to, you know how your stories can change when you have a little bit of distance from it and you start putting pieces together that may not have really been related until you sort of step away from it.
Uh-huh.
So the story that I tell in my first TED Talk, because I have three TED Talks.
And okay.
The first one is the one I think you're talking about, which is where I talk about my falling out of the parasail, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was 20 years old when I fell out of the parasail. I was in Mexico. I lived in San Diego, so it was very easy to go down to Rosarito with a bunch of friends and, you know, do what you do when you're under. You can't do then you're in the States. So do the math, right? So so I'm down there and I get very, you know, I it was a long time before I could get on the parasail, and it was a long time to be drinking, you know, local drinks. So you can imagine what those were. So by the time I got up there, I was like to the wind, right? And when I fell out of the parasail, when I was up there, I fainted twice while I was up there. You know, I won't go into the long story of why I fainted, but I fainted.
Uh-huh.
And when I woke up, I was still up in the parasail. So parasail ropes are about 500 feet long. So about maybe 200 to 300 feet up in the air. So I'm floating there. I'm hanging there up in the air, and I wake up out of this, you know, this unconsciousness, and all I could think about is how much pain I'm in because the harnesses wrong. And when I released myself, I flipped and I was hanging there upside down from my knees. And then finally I just let go. And I was actually heading into the water head first.
Gosh.
I would have completely broken my neck had I not flipped. Something flipped me. And then when I landed in the water, I landed in sitting position. I ended up breaking my back in three places, but didn't need any surgery or anything. It's like a total miracle, you guys. And when I floated up, I was in a vest and I was floating face down. And again, another opportunity for me to like die, right? Because I even had that moment where I do believe I did. I mean, some people have those crossover moments and they have those moments where they can talk about what it looked like, what it felt like. That absolutely was my story. But the thing is, when I think about it, you know, I got pulled out of the water just in time. But as I was still in there, I remember just becoming like one with the water. All of a sudden, you know, all of my cells that were all full of water in my water body dissolve, right? That's what it felt like. And then I remember thinking to myself, you know, water saved me. Had I landed on, had I landed on the beach, I would have been dead. I would have been broken.
Oh, right.
So many broken pieces to my body, but the water broke my fall. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, when I look back at that story, I think to myself, oh my God, that's when I became water's bitch.
I'm a water girl.
That's totally inappropriate. That's what it was. It's like now all of a sudden I am in total service to water.
I know.
My life, water. So now I have to, you know, I have to
bow down to water. I don't think anybody calls you water bitch, right?
Yeah.
I think they call you water lady. Yeah. That's funny.
That is funny. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Gosh, Gemma, yeah, that tells us, this is a great story we can tell our college kids to, don't go to Mexico. Mexico and do those parasailings.
I know, because you know what happened to Gemma, but you know,
that
something came out of it.
Right? But Gemma, I want to go back to what you were talking about, how, you know, I know that you told me that now you teach at Stanford and an Ivy League school here in California, Claremont McKenna, which is actually amazing that you're a professor there. And, you know, I know there is a point that you got called and you said, like, oh gosh, I don't think I'm good enough. Like, how can, now we have students right now, our college students are getting accepted to college and they get accepted and they're saying like, oh, but maybe I'm not good enough. Like, maybe, do I deserve to be there? I mean, even as adults, we're saying that, like, do I deserve to be at this table? Like, tell me your thought process. How did you go through that? And, you know, give us some advice on how to move forward with that.
Sure. I think, you know, imposter syndrome is real, people. I mean, it is so, so real, especially with women of color. I mean, statistically, you know, when men will apply for jobs, they will apply when they meet 70% of the criteria. When women do, they will wait until they meet 100% of the criteria. And that's one of the challenges. I mean, just that is, I mean, that to me is just basic, right? It's because you need to be in the game to actually play the game, right?
Right.
You can't if you don't put yourself out there, then it doesn't matter how amazing you are. People might not even recognize it because you didn't put your hat in the ring. Right. And I think for me, I, the way I deal with it, especially because I taught at Stanford, my entry point into academia was I was invited to be a fellow at Stanford. And then, from the work I did there, I got recruited at Claremont McKenna. And, you know, for me, I never would have imagined that being my trajectory. I don't have the degrees that you're supposed to have in order to be like a full-on professor, but I teach at these, you know, prestigious universities. And most of the reason is because I know my stuff and I absolutely believe I know it. And I know I have something to share. And I think what helped me to feel better in academia, because that's a place I can feel the smallest, right? Because I'm like, I don't have the degrees that any of these people have. I don't have the same amount of research, but what I do have is the field experience. What I do have is the experience that oftentimes researchers won't be able to speak to, right?
Right.
And what was great about the classes that we taught at Stanford, that I co-taught at Stanford, was the professor talked about the concepts of the social innovation and social entrepreneurship, and I could talk about the realities. Yeah, that's certainly is a great, you know, insight about that, but here's what really happens on the ground. And you just need to believe you know what you know and own what mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
And I think oftentimes women, especially women of color, will sort of sometimes hide behind their accolades because they're torn between, you know, do I want to sound humble or do
right.
I want to be, you know, do I want to be recognized?
Because we're taught to be humble.
Totally.
You know, people don't get the credit because they're just humble about it and they don't want to boast about their things. So you went through that.
I went through that and I owned what I did. I'm out there in the world telling people I've won an award at the World Economic Forum, right?
Uh-huh.
I am out there in the world
Good
saying
for you.
That. You know what I mean? Because it's not a lie and it's not, right. it actually stops the questions. And that's
right.
what you want to do. You want to stop the questions.
Right. right. And it brings credibility to yourself, which is
totally.
Great.
Totally.
So Gemma, can you elaborate on your Million Voice Choir? That blows me away. It's just so inspirational. And for someone to have the world sing at the same time, your song, how did you manage that?
Yeah, that was, I have to say, if, you know, of all the things that I feel like I'm probably the most proud of is that, because it was completely done out of love. You know, I didn't make mm-hmm. any money off of it. In fact, you know, I trusted the universe. It was my exercise in trusting the universe because because the kind of things that were happening when I started to build the choir. So the model was, you know, the strategy was, you know, we tried to reach out to conferences that convened people around peace, that convened people around, you know, empowerment, that convened people around, you know, conflict resolution, that kind of thing. And we basically just said, you know, I have a song and I would love to share it with your group and then and teach people to sing it so that they can take it with them. So that was the model, right? We just reached out to a bunch of, like a handful of conferences, and then all of a sudden people around the world started hearing about this. And I also, I had a pretty decent following from being a jazz singer. I had a following in San Francisco, mm-hmm. Los Angeles, and New York. And I had asked people to, you know, say, I said, look, this is what happened. September 11th happened, and this is where I am now. And I wrote a song. Wow. You resonate with it, forward it to your friends. And this was before Facebook, before Twitter, before That's Instagram, amazing. Before any of that stuff. It was literally by word of mouth. And so what I would do is I'd go around the world, I'd sing the song, I'd teach people the song while I was at this conference, and then I'd give them access to this, I'd give them a CD with the song with all the vocals and then a karaoke version so that they Right. didn't have to, you know, put together a band for it. And so as I was traveling, literally people were taking the songs, forming their own choirs from wherever they were. One of the reasons we had over 60 cities over 100 cities in 60 countries join us was because Jane Goodall, one of my idols, woman with the chimpanzees.
Uh-huh.
We just happened to keep stumbling upon each other at all these different conferences. And when I first met her, I introduced myself. She's like, Gemma, I've heard all about you. You know what I mean? You're just like, wait a minute, hold on.
Wait.
Her Jane Goodall. And so she invited her network to join. I mean, all of these conferences, you know, invited everybody that were part of it. And people actually mobilized their own choirs. And so on September 21st, 2004, which was the day we asked everyone to sing from all over the globe, actually Jane introduced me. We had a big event Wow. in New York City. And the invitation was for people wherever they were to sing We Rise at every at 9 o'clock in the morning or at 9 o'clock at night. From all around the world. So there were people
amazing.
Singing at every hour around the globe. And it was extraordinary because it had never been done before. And, you know, certainly there's capacity to do it now because of, right. you know, internet and stuff. I mean, because of social media. But this was, I mean, I had email. That's all I had. I had an email account and that was it. And so it was extraordinary that it built so quickly. There was so much, there were so many ambassadors, you know, who were promoting the song wherever they were. And we had like Archbishop Desmond Tutu join us. We had
That's Peter amazing. Peter.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it was extraordinary. And I think, you know, but that day I do remember feeling really, you know, relieved and proud and also very melancholy because I remember thinking that day, wow, we did it. 7 minutes of song, right? That's kind of cool that we all sang it together.
Right.
Now it's minute eight. What do I do now? Right. right? So, right. What's and that? That's when it was like, all right, shift into water gear. Right. And start.
That's amazing. Is it ever going to go into a 2 million voice choir? We can do it.
Yeah. So this year is the 20th anniversary of September 11th. I wasn't sure if I was, I don't know if we're going to do something special for this year, only because there's so many other things going on and I, you know, it really should not kind of take away from September 11th. So mm-hmm. we're definitely thinking about what it could look like in the future. At the right time, we had some thoughts that we might do something with COVID frontline workers, but you know, that there's a big concert going on for that one already.
Right.
So just trying to figure out the next, and I think We Rise is going to have its, you know, like I said, it has its own life. It's going to emerge again when it's ready.
It's a second edition, probably, right?
Yes, exactly.
You know, you talked about it at the beginning about your journey and how you actually literally saw how that was supposed to play out.
Yeah.
And you achieved it. And, you know, it just reminds me of a spiritual talk I listened to where they said, just give you a little and with faith, it will grow. So it's just definitely your story.
Yeah.
So you just had that little thought and it grew. So.
I also have to say, I had a big mindset change at the time too, because, you know, there were many moments I was very exhausted. You know, there were times I was sleeping in my car. There were times I had to sleep on park benches. There were times, I mean, it wasn't all wonderful. And, you know, there were moments where I was utterly, utterly, utterly exhausted. And I remember at one point getting, again, frustrated and thinking, oh my, I should just go home. You know, we're done. This is good. You know, we did something pretty incredible. I can just go home. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, and then something extraordinary would happen. And then I'd be like, okay, I'm supposed to be back on this. And then I remember making a deal with God.
Oh,
all right, God, no, but this is a good one. Not like, you know, take that, you know, take me. It wasn't anything like that. It was like, all right, I will absolutely be at your, you know, at the service of this song and the service of this mission. But in order for me to know that I'm supposed to be on this mission, I don't just, you know, I speak the language of miracles. The way I know that I'm supposed to be doing this is you need to give me miracles like regularly. So I know I'm on the right track. And so that's when all the miracles started to happen.
Wow.
Really. Meeting Jane Goodall, you know, having that woman, you know, find me on the streets of Spain, you know, getting a round the world ticket from a stranger, you know, all of these crazy things. Just, you know, I just opened myself up to the universe and said, you know, I don't speak English. I speak miracles. So show me miracles.
Well, and God was definitely talking to you.
Yes.
Definitely. I think that is good points that you brought up. You brought up things that, you know, it was a thought process. Things did work out, but there were some down points that you can, you know, give up. And those are things that we all need to listen to, that, you know, there's something that's in our heart, but there is going to be ups and downs. But I like the fact that you always looked for something that always would move you forward. So those are important lessons for all of us to listen to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So you're still recording, right? I mean, you have an album and I know you have a movie.
Yes. So,
yay!
Wow.
So some people baked during COVID. I made a movie. So
yay! Go, you go, girl.
I wrote a soundtrack. So a friend of mine, my best friend from college, he wrote a movie that I fell in love with, and I offered to be one of the producers, and we filmed it back in June, with you know, when things were sort of lifting in Portland, and right. And then I took over the music and produced the music and wrote a few extra songs for it, and one of the songs that I helped produce was called, because the movie's called Christmas Freak. It's a, a holiday movie. And one of the songs was called Cool Christmas. And when I rewrote it, we recorded it. And a friend of ours who used to work at Disney and Fox, he's like, this song could actually be a commercial hit if we record it, right? Re-record it. And so we re-recorded it. And in December, on the day that I was supposed to listen to it in the studio, my friend who actually interviewed me recently for my jazz album, he was one of the engineers on it. He said, let's listen to it and play it on the radio when we first listened to it. So we played it on the radio. I had no idea what it sounded like. It was stunning. It sounded like, you know, one of those big sweeping Natalie Cole strings, you know, jazz ballad.
Right.
And I played it, and we got such a great reaction. Other DJs on the other shows actually requested to play it. There were requests from the radio, so we ended up just posting it on, God, I think it was like SoundCloud, and then they played it in the UK, and we ended up getting played in 28 countries.
Wow!
And over 60 cities in 10 days, because we only had, because it was December 20th, we had 10 days of holiday left, and so it got all this airplay over that time, and that's what made me realize I should probably put my album out again. So that's when we did the jazz album in March.
That's nice. Great.
You need to tell your friend to actually develop a movie about your life.
Yeah.
That is actually,
that would be amazing.
Yes.
Yes. We kind of already, it's, I've had these different ideas because I've been asked to write my autobiography for a very long time, or my memoir, and I just haven't gotten around to it. So this might be a good opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Yes. You definitely have to do that. Definitely.
Is the movie ready to go?
So the movie is, we're just finishing it off. We had a feedback screening. So a feedback screening is when you get an audience and they give you their responses and they tell you how it might be improved or what they liked about it. Mm-hmm. So we had that about a month ago. We've made some more edits. We're going to have another screening, another feedback screening in LA in a few weeks. And once that's done, it's going to be final and ready for whatever the life it takes on. So we've been pursuing festivals, and we're also looking to try and sell it to one of the streaming services.
Awesome.
Nice. Gemma, I know that you have been really great about surrounding yourself with different people and different people and learning from them. So, you know, tell us how we can, you know, how do we find those people in our lives?
Sure. That's such a great question, because honestly, there's no way I would have not gotten here without the help of so many wonderful, wonderful people who weren't experts. They weren't like, you know, top researchers in their field. They were people who knew local stories and local issues. They were people who knew how to get me from one place to the next. And oftentimes the lessons that you learn from other people aren't what you think. You know, if I'm meeting a person who's a doctor, maybe the thing I'm learning from them is not just about health. I might be learning other things. I might be learning more about how to approach approach my health, or what kind of mindsets I need to have, but maybe not so much about health, right? There's so many ways that you can surround yourself with people who sort of send yourself as someone who wants to learn everything. And that was, I think, what helped me. I loved going into situations where I didn't know anything, because then I didn't have to prove anything, one, right? Mm-hmm. And two, all I was doing was learning, and I knew that I could contribute something in these conversations. And I think where I really excelled is I always surrounded myself with people who were smarter than me. I had zero, zero, zero ego about that when it came to learning what I needed to learn to become, you know, to do the water work I did, because I was very comfortable with the fact that I didn't know certain things. And I was very comfortable with the fact that, and very excited about the fact that I was going to learn if I just listened, mm-hmm. right? And so I think for me, surrounding, you know, that this kind of goes in line with your last question about, you know, what's advice you can tell a young woman. It's like, it's okay to not know anything, because we all start out not knowing anything. And then and then if we dive into it, we ask the right questions, we listen deeply, we're going to advance ourselves no matter what, right? And it's, if you just approach it in that way, and you know, there are times I've had to come to the table knowing exactly and being the expert, but I would say most of the tables I didn't have to do that. That's okay, because I always know there's so much I can learn from other people.
Right.
Wow, fantastic points. Thank you.
Thank you, Gemma.
Sure.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you one more thing. It's two more things. What is your favorite mantra, or something that you say to yourself every day, or your quote that you say to yourself, and why?
I know. So So I love water mantras. I mean, water sayings, anything that has water in it. So one of my favorites is the work an unknown good person has done is like a vein of water flowing hidden underground, secretly making the ground green. So, you know, there is this really beautiful way that, you know, all of us are if we just behave like water, right, we will either be powerful above ground or even hidden underground and secretly make the ground green. So it's not really a mantra, but it's one of my favorite sayings.
That's beautiful. So one last thing here, Gemma.
Yes.
As you said at the beginning, your motto to it takes a single drop to create a wave. It's very, it parallels with ours. It just takes a spark to ignite the world ablaze. Yeah. So just your one last tip that you can give to all our Sylvian sisters, how to be that single drop or that spark in this world.
So I'm going to use another wonderful water saying that I love. So one of the things that I think holds us back is ourselves. I mean, I think, you know, there is so much, we have so much power. We have other people telling us what we should be doing or how we should be behaving. And the thing is, we know ourselves how powerful we are, but we need to be able to unleash that ourselves and not for ourselves, right? Not just because me, Gemma, wants to uplift myself and be able to, you know, be famous or be or be significant or do whatever, right? If you see yourself as in this, my favorite phrase, it's a rising tide lifts all boats. We are not the boats in the story. We are mm-hmm. the tide. So if all of us as those drops of water within that tide do this, it will uplift us all. It's not just going to be for us as individuals. It will be for all Filipinos. It will be for all Asians. It will be for everyone. The whole world will be uplifted if we don't see ourselves as the boat, but we see ourselves as the tide.
Thank you, Gemma, for being so inspiring to us. This has been fun. You're so charming, so great to listen to. Love your story.
Your stories are amazing.
Yes, and really fun. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gemma. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. We wish you great health and happiness. Stay safe, make good choices, and we hope to see you soon.